Hey y'all, this is Kamau Akabuizi, one of your hosts of The Stages. This special time capsule episode is one of those times when we get together to discuss a major event. That might be something that happens in our lives, it might be something that happens in our sons' lives or our family's lives, or it may be something that is a major event in the cultural or societal landscape. Naturally, January 6th and the violent insurrection that took place in Washington, D.C., and was also bubbling in other cities across the United States was one of those moments, one where we felt we should get together and have a deep dive conversation on this particular instance, as well as its impact on us as fathers and what it makes us think about. When we got together to record this episode, we were trying out a new recording platform that we love a lot, but because of some difficulties, there are a few little hitches in the audio, mostly related to my voice in this episode, but our producer did the best job he could to pull it together. So just wanted to let you know that in advance, let you know that we're always working on making this a quality audio product for you, and look forward to your thoughts and feedback on this episode. Please do enjoy.
We have died enough and have wasted time enough trying to make this country and these people better. Like I said, we're the paint people coming to the house, getting killed, trying to fix their house. Fuck their house and fuck them. But what we do have from a historical standpoint is a case study. We have a case study that is so profound that there will always be somebody who is not in the smoke and mirrors of white supremacism to see what took place January 6, 2021, and understand with clarity that white supremacism is more important to the United States for at least half of this country.
I'm Kamau Akabuizi, a creative and strategist, and I've got a 13-year-old son that you'll get to know as the H.
What's up, y'all? My name is Kamau Ware. I'm the principal of Kamau Studios, the founder of Black Optimum Experience. And you're going to get to know my son, who's 23 now, whose name is Spades.
What's good, good people? My name is Adrian Franks, mostly known by the name AD, creative designer, inventor, just overall human being. You get to know my son by the name of Garvey, who is now 2 years old.
And this is The Stages, where three Black fathers at various stages of parenthood discuss our health journeys, physical, mental, and professional, and how fatherhood inspires our connected paths. We all carry a lot on our shoulders as a part of the human experience, and often you need a friend to carry that weight with you. That's why it's so important that you sincerely check in with your people on a regular basis. Kamau, Adrian, and I do this every episode with a segment called The Weigh-In.
I get a relatively random text from Spades this morning, like about 9-something. He tells me a stock to check for. Like, yo, I'm watching this stock. Let me know what you think. And then I send him some stocks that we're checking for. And so right now, me and Spades share watch lists for things to look out for. And then I'm like, yo, bro, I know what I'm going to get you for your 25th birthday. He goes, what? And I was like, well, you know, me and Kizza just had this ceremony in California. It was 2 days. It was just a dope spiritual ceremony. I was like, I'm going to get it for your 25th birthday. He sends me a FWMN. And I was just kind of like, oh, fuck with me now. That's his way of saying now. Let's do it now. And I was just kind of like, well, listen, I'll be talking to the shaman this week. I think it'd be good for 25. But if you want it sooner, I'll let you know. But he's like, that sounds like a life-changing experience. Basically, fuck with me now. Like, put me in the game. I want to experience that. It's just interesting that I'm about to talk to Soul Twin over here, Kizza. And then like this morning, my son is saying like, yo, what you described, y'all went through, I'm trying to get that in my life ASAP.
I imagine that a lot of people are, given with the state of the world, right? And anytime I have a conversation for context, Kamau and I were out in California. I've been working with my coach and shaman for about 11 months. And we were invited to his property for a spiritual journey, a infused ceremony and journey into the psilocybin cosmos. It was an experience that is very difficult to put into words. It changes a lot of mindsets and a lot of the way that we see, think about, react to, I mean, a lot. And we're still in the process of even processing what our experience was. And in the wake of the thing that we've seen and experienced in the days subsequent to that, I'm curious, Kamau, how you digested the events of this week in the mindset that you're in now, you know, as we're still processing a lot of our experience from last weekend.
Well, before I do that, I have to ask AD, because it was a 2-day ceremony, and AD, Kamau and I both thought about you and thought about your wife, who's also our friend and fam. We were like, man, I wonder if AD would do this. And I wonder if he would do this as solo or with his wife. Like, so yeah, before I even get into that, that question will not be dodged. Have you ever considered having, and this is like my third time doing shrooms. I did shrooms in 1997 and also in 2006. And so this is basically every decade or so, 20s, 30s, now 40s. Have you ever considered something like a guided psilocybin / mushroom journey by somebody who actually understands or is a practitioner of plant-based medicines?
I'm definitely into plant-based medicines. I mean, I used to be vegetarian. My dad went through a lot of things around plant-based holistic healing when he was going through his cancer treatment like 27 years ago. I guess for me, I would have to, it's more of a personal thing. If I'm going to do that, I feel like my optimistic side said, yeah, that sounds pretty dope. My cynic side of my brain is like, well, I need to get more information about who this person is, right? Just because if I'm going to be in a vulnerable kind of state, then I need to fully trust who's taking me on this journey. Otherwise, I personally can't do it. Now, I can't really speak for Nicole. And it's funny because, you know, we've been together now 17 years, but I try not to say what she would or wouldn't do. She do have her own personal shaman that she consults with here on in. I mean, you know, every so often when she needed. It's definitely a relationship between her and that person, right? And I think it's a very beautiful thing. And that's the whole point, I guess, I'm making that. It's a personal thing for me. Like, if she would be cool with it, then I'll be cool with it. But even then, I still have to feel like I have to know that person, like, beyond just a few times. Like, they have to almost be, like, family, like how you guys are. So it had to be one of those things where I need to probably be around this person for a substantial amount of time. And I'm talking years. So that's just the Scorpio part of who I am, just naturally cynical or skeptical of people until I really get to know you. If you with me, we rocking. If I don't really know you, nothing against you, but I really can't rock with you, whatever you're doing. And it could be that you give me like a great glass of water, which is the most essential thing on the planet. I'm still going to be skeptical of drinking that water. That's just kind of who I am. So open to it, but it has to be somebody I have to fully trust.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, to frame how I saw it, one of the things that I remember watching in the documentary, which I'm going to quote as a way to like couch a lot of my perspectives on it, is that part of why the Spanish church, the Catholics, like shut down indigenous people utilizing the sacred mushroom is because it didn't coincide with the colonial thinking. It's like, we're not trying to have you connected to the earth and the universe independent of our church. We got to get rid of everything you're doing, and we got to bring in white Jesus and our Bible. And so we got to like disconnect you from the universe and from God, basically, to have what we say is God. And then also looking at how like in the 1960s, it was like, yo, people are taking these different psychedelic drugs and they're looking at the universe differently and reinterpreting reality and creating new pathways of thought that says it doesn't make sense for us to go across the planet and shoot people because they have a different political view than we do. They haven't attacked us, right? And so when I look at people who are storming the capital, it's this major prism of really people coming to an awareness that is almost like a foregone conclusion for people like ourselves. Like we understand, like when people are watching white people storm the capital and they're like, how did this happen? I'm watching it while I'm editing a film. And once I saw them get on the steps, I was like, whoa, inside job. First, second, third of all the senators were there. If you go to the Capitol in the summertime when sessions are not even in session, when the senators are home, you still can't get on the steps when there's no politicians in the building. This was a very unique moment where you had all the Senate, all the house and people were on the steps, I was like, what you're looking at is how white supremacy works. Not only are they not afraid of these protesters, clearly they're in on it. So whether you're the president or you're a senator or you're dressed in horns and you're naked with some pants on damn near rushing the Capitol, you're all white supremacists in your own way, which means you're not going to only not have resistance. You're going to have a welcome open gate to come and storm the Capitol. And at that point in time, I was like, them cats is in trouble. Those guys are in danger. And I think that people are just so far in the mire of the smoke and mirrors that white supremacism hides in. You know what I'm saying? White supremacism hides in all these cloaks that people can't see it for what it is. And it almost got a lot of people killed. And that's what I saw. I just saw people just like so lost, bro. So lost and just lying to themselves so much about the fact that America, the United States of America, is more invested in white supremacism than laws. And for some people, that was an eye opener.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you just look at it, I think more and more of rational thinking white Americans, I'm just going to say it like that. I'm not even going to say liberal Americans. I'm just going to say more rational white Americans that you can more or less reason with and not necessarily agree with. They are actually more surprised that this happened. Whereas more and more people of color or any non-white person easily understand that, yeah, we've been telling y'all this was because it's happened to us. It happened to us all the time, right? When people burn West Tulsa or Rosewood or even the Atlanta riots or any other city that's obviously had tensions with the government, local police, and just riots of like white people, that happened to us all the time, randomly, right? Or even planned, whatever case may be. I think what turned America around this week, or turned us upside down, is that the elite white people, or the regional, rational thinking white people, we never thought this would happen. It happened to them. And that's what they didn't expect, that they could get bum rushed like that, right? They never thought that, oh, this could happen to us. So that's why they didn't have the National Guard there, because they never thought these people never bum rushed the nation's capital, right? They expect us to do that, but we know better to do that. They're afraid of us doing that, but they never expect their own or that sector of America to actually do that. Because that sector of America, unfortunately, is the same sector of America that was used to keep us in check, because they were the police. The first police department or false police squads are them. And that's why the police invited him into, you said, Kamau, professor, that it was an open letter. It was an open gate. Come right on in. They showed policemen pushing them towards this place. They showed the policemen standing to the side and letting them into the Capitol, right? It was only the Secret Service men and all those guys who took the step further and started popping people.
There was military in that group.
There was military and police. It was military and police in that group. That's America, though, bro. But we've been saying this is nothing new for us.
That's why, like, my last word on it was, for some people, that was a wake-up call. For us, it's like, bro, that's not...
what we've been saying.
Black people have been the North Star of the United States consciousness. We've been their Jiminy Cricket before 1776. And I'm tired of being that cricket on their shoulder. How many of us got to die to make y'all improve the integrity? It's like, you just said that you can't get to your Zoom mic if somebody's painting your house, right? How many painters would that company send to your house if you keep killing the paint people? If everybody come to your house to paint your house, somehow you and your wife just kill them and bury them in the backyard. How many times that company say, hey, yo, AD, we do want to paint your house, but you seem to keep murdering our staff. Maybe we're going to stop sending people to your house to paint your home. You know what I'm saying? It's like, yo, America, we've been telling y'all through every amendment that you have, that you have white terrorism, that you kill other citizens, and you allow it.
But they know it. They allow it. It just happened to them. And that's why they pissed. Because it always happened to us.
But they also lie to themselves. I'm not disagreeing with you. What you're saying is true. But I want to add, they lie to themselves and say, this isn't who we are. It is who we are.
At a certain point, I wonder when that segment of society, liberal, non-reactive, is going to stop never thinking. Because I never thought that this guy could get elected. And it shocked to the core. They never thought that this election opposition could reach the fever pitch that it has reached. They never thought that a president could say, do, act, react the way that this president has over the past 12 years, but even much more so over the past 4 years. And they never thought that what happened on Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever day it
January
was.
January 6th.
January 6th.
They will remember or live in infamy.
Will it? Will it?
Yes, it will.
Right? But they never thought that this could happen as well. Even though in the prior days, somebody went to some company to print shirts that said Civil War, January 6th.
They were wearing those shirts.
They never thought this could happen. But those shirts were printed in advance, mailed somewhere in advance. Men got on planes with those shirts on in advance, left hotels in advance, in the public eye with those shirts on.
Bro, there was a clubhouse room last Monday called Proud Boys Are Going to Turn Up DC on January 6th. It's a clubhouse room.
I was in that room. I was checking it out. I'm like, yo, all the signs have been here. They've been telling us.
Yeah, I mean, T-shirts, yes. T-shirts, Facebook, Twitter,
the president,
clubhouse.
Bro, the president told y'all. But this goes back to a bigger thing that I think a certain group of us understand the power of amplifying things, right? If you're in marketing, you get that, right? Like, influence can amplify a brand's voice. A person such as 45, he's an amplifier of these narratives that white people have bought into, which is the sense of patriotism and preserving history and owning, supposedly, this is our country. The reality of it is, it's never been our country. It's black people, right? That's not our narrative. But a guy like him amplified this weird narrative and used that narrative as a weapon to turn the people against itself, right? So if you just think about it, especially at a place that we are now where there are like really great tools that can amplify anything. So everything from a clubhouse to Twitter to even a podcast to whatever, it shows you that the office of the president of the United States' biggest thing and its biggest weapon is that it can amplify it, the voice. It's a voice that people listen and really take heart and pay attention to. We try to say that a president has power. A president does have power. They have a lot of power, a lot more power than we actually thought, right? Outside of just power with the military and the Defense Department, the president literally can tell people to do things. And there are a certain sector of people who would do this shit. And I think America finally sees that. Now, what does America does with this going forward? Who knows? We'll see. But this is definitely unprecedented times. And we've seen that this guy has tested the power of that office and pushed it to its max beyond dropping bombs on other countries.
COVID was already one thing that has never happened on the earth before. No one alive has experienced the kind of impact that COVID has had on the earth. And now we've experienced something that is, even if you compare it to 1812 when the British stormed the capital, it's still unprecedented because this was an insurrection within its own nation. So we're living in multiple layers of historic moments. And I have to just like throw a little bit of shade toward Twitter and Facebook. So get ready for some shade.
Oh, give them the smoke. Give them the smoke, bro.
Both y'all fools kicked Farrakhan off your platforms like 2 years ago.
They kicked Alex Jones off. They kicked Alex Jones and Farrakhan off.
But they're like, Farrakhan's too dangerous
mm-hmm.
to be on Facebook and to be on Twitter. He's too dangerous to be on your platforms, but do y'all want to like have a debate with him on TV? No. Donald Trump has been somebody who has literally been telling people to kill people. And they're like, yeah, it's not that bad. And now they're like, damn, I guess we got to get him off our platform. And now that he's off their platform, he's a little less dangerous. You know what I mean? Like, me and Kizzle went to the Million Man March 1995. If you fuck around and just like pee on a tree or go the wrong way, the way that DC was on lock in 1995 for black men coming to, I mean, it's just like, I don't care what your point of view is. And you know who my litmus test is right now for where white America can go? My favorite Florida man of all time is Joe Scarborough. I feel like Joe Scarborough is about 2 years ahead of white people's sense of self. He left the Republican Party and began criticizing Trump and has been calling out other Republican white men who carry water for Trump. And I listen to his podcast or his Morning Joe show. I just like the way he thinks. The anger and the realness. I haven't heard a white man speak so real about white supremacy as Joe Scarborough. And when I first started listening to Joe Scarborough, he was like, hated Al Gore, loved Bush, didn't like too many black leaders, but didn't love them either. But he was like, if these were black people, they'd have been shot in the face before it even got to the steps. Like, I don't want to say, like I said, I'm tired of being Jiminy Cricket, but I feel like if people could just like follow his trajectory of understanding, then yeah, I think that white people will see January 6th as the moment where they was like, oh, white supremacy actually is not okay because people who are white supremacists care more about whiteness than the United States. And it's like, for black people, it's like, no shit.
But there's no requirement to, Kamala, that's the problem. There's no requirement for white people to look at what has just happened and give it any more import than any other things that have happened over the course of the past 10, 12 years in this regard. This has been building for more than a decade, and this has been building towards this from the Tea Party, from the Civil Rights era. It's just a slow boil. It's just a slow boil. And even when, and I'll read a quick clip of an article that struck me this morning in this regard, even when Republicans, white people signal very, very specifically their ideology from levels of power, it does not raise the right flags. Illinois Republican Mary Miller, sorry for quoting Hitler in Capitol speech. A newly elected Republican congresswoman has apologized for quoting Hitler in a speech in Washington. In a statement, Mary Miller of Illinois said she sincerely apologized for any offense, given what she told a crowd at the U.S. Capitol. This is her quote. Hitler was right on one thing. He said, whoever has the youth has the future. Our children are being propagandized. Miller paraphrased Hitler, who in 1935 told a rally, he alone who owns the youth gains the future. On Tuesday of this week, in an address to a Save the Republic event hosted by Moms for America, a right-wing group which campaigns to reclaim our culture for truth, family, and freedom, right? These are all these signals. All these are right here. She apologized, and I'm trying to find the quote in this article really quickly because that thing's actually really engaging in this narrative. Basically, she defends her quote, and it was taken out of context, and then requotes Hitler in her apology. Now, where are her constituents' call for her to step down? Where is the uprising against even that little bit of signaling to a group of people that this is our ideology and this is how you should be thinking alongside me as a representative of you, the people? They don't ever have to contextualize these things the right way. They don't have to think about any of this and go back and reflect and do what Joe Scarborough has done in understanding, educating himself, being a part of the opposition to this insanity. They don't have to, because their lives don't change and aren't affected that greatly by these type of events. Where is the actual need for any change for them?
Yeah, you're right. It's like, until 45 got in office, white people truly started understanding what it feels to be a nigga. Trump made certain sectors of white people feel like us. Or more so, they started understanding like, oh, what is meant to be attacked like a nigga. And until they actually get them nigga lessons that your boy talked about, Chappelle talked about, hey, this is the nigga lesson right now, bro. Until they start getting more smoke what happened last week at the Capitol, I hate to say that ain't the last time this is going to happen. What happened at the nation's capital? That's going to now start probably happening at state capitals.
It did happen at state capitals the same day.
See? So you got to see more smoke, bro. Because to your point, kids, it's no skin in the game, man. It's, I mean, they can just go back to just dealing with this shit. They got cousins and uncles just who think this way, but they still sit down and have Thanksgiving dinner with them or go shooting with them or dog hunting or not even dog hunting, fox hunting with a fucking dog or whatever, right? It's just, they can still be white regardless, and it just doesn't affect them. They can still go invest in the stock market, which is doing well, bull market, whatever, right? And still make money. They can travel to the deepest part of this country that I would never go to, and it would never ever be profiled. They can go to a goddamn Klan rally and have a beer, and it won't affect them. Hell, they can go to the hood. They can go and interview known gangs in our neighborhood and probably feel safer than we ever could because they are white and they are privileged. So until they start getting that smoke like everybody else, they're not going to change.
Those Republican leaders who changed their tune after the insurrection and decided not to vote against certifying the vote, those individuals have been applauded. Every complicit act that they committed along the way led to this. Now they're applauded for making a reasonable choice. just reasonable, not even decent, a reasonable choice after the nation's capital was overtaken by ideologues on every channel in the world.
So two things. Number one, neither one of your points of view that I've heard and I've had comments to say about you, neither one of y'all are wrong about none of that. And so just there will forever be. And when I say forever, as long as there is a sun and there is somebody who is creamier than Drake in his hemisphere, there will always be white supremacism. I don't care if it's two motherfuckers at the beach with suntan lotion reading Hitler books, right? There will always be that. It's 2021 and there's still shaman. There's still indigenous people practicing their ceremonies that are thousands of years old. America has created a manner of thinking that really was exported to Germany. Hitler got a lot of his ideology from the United States. Like, eugenics is not German. Eugenics is an American English word that was exported to Germany. He was inspired by the United States 19th century thinking. So when people in this hemisphere quote Hitler, I'm often underwhelmed by the historic impact of it because Hitler is already following us, right? And so that's going to happen. We're going to have those folks. And number two,
but again, this is a congresswoman. This isn't a dude in a horn.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It's all the same. They're all the same.
It matters because you refer to as a clown. Whatever the punishment is for that guy, it is not enough. It is not enough. Whatever it is not enough. Mary Miller's hanging out in Congress.
The reason why I say it doesn't matter is because the Congress has always had those people. This is not a flashpoint. The fact that we have a congressperson quoting Hitler is not a flashpoint because Congress already had the thinking that Hitler borrowed from before Hitler was born. So this is consistent. This is like seeing a cloud. You're not wrong. Everything you're saying, yes. What I'm trying to get at, like I said, just like point number one, is like, yes, you're correct, but understand that, not you understand, I know you get this, but what I'm getting at, the point that I'm making more for our audience than for YouTube is that that's always going to be around as long as there's somebody more light than Drake in this hemisphere. The United States created white supremacism and was rebuilt and refashioned in the image of white supremacism. Between 1783 and 1863, it was locked in. And the amendments that allowed our ancestors to walk off plantations and to vote and to have citizenship, all that is on a document. But the culture, the mentality, the thinking, the blood and the soul lineage of the people who are invested in white supremacism, that is more powerful than a piece of paper. It's not going away. So I'm not even trying to change minds and hearts of white people. That's my second point. I'm not invested in their mental well-being. So A, it's going to be here. B, I'm not here saying, let me go and change your perspective because we have died enough and have wasted time enough trying to make this country and these people better. Like I said, we're the paint people coming to the house, getting killed, trying to fix their house. Fuck their house and fuck them. But what we do have from a historical standpoint is a case study. We have a case study that is so profound that there will always be somebody who is not in the smoke and mirrors of white supremacism to see what took place January 6, 2021 and understand with clarity that white supremacism is more important to the United States for at least half of this country.
You know, I was looking, I saw you texting our thread and that was really how I knew what was going on. I was on calls and I came upstairs to put on the live feed and the H was up here scrolling through Discord. And as soon as I put it on, he knew what was happening, but he was kind of like, he said to me that he knew what was happening, but he didn't really understand it because he was taking in all of the feedback basically from Discord, from game players all over the world with their reactions to what was happening. I was struck by that. I was struck by some of the things that I was reading, just the volume, the absolute volume of what was happening, because I know he has friends in Europe and Asia and he's listening to voices from all over the world. And so you're seeing, again, kind of like the global reach and impact of, you know, what's happening in the States in real time, as we always do. But then I sit down and kind of like calmly watched it. Naturally had some reaction once the president's message of support came on the air, right? And that he was allowed to in a address to the world, an address to the nation, an address to his followers and his fellow insurrectionists, that on that platform, he still was able to lie. He was still able to put forward the same messages that led to this insurrection. He professed his love for them. He told them they're special people. And naturally, I had some reaction to that. But my reaction to George Floyd's murder was exponentially more impactful, more resonant, just incredibly more poignant than this. I've been saying this since 2014, right? That this is coming, that a civil war of some sort is coming. The writing was on the wall for a very long time. This was just the day that it happened. But I never expected 2020 for George Floyd to be murdered the way that he was, right? And that's what I'm saying about the impact of yesterday and the moment and the way that that story will be told, the way it'll be litigated, the narratives that will be strewn about, the applause for insurrectionists all of a sudden had to change their tune as voters for the American future. There's an apology and a support and a apathy inherent in the country for white supremacy. That is the most dangerous part. It's the apathy, it's the apologies for it, and it's the ability to, I've changed my mind a little bit because of everything that's happened. All these, I've changed my mind a little bit. I'm going to make an effort to change it. I just need to change my mind a little bit. And there's an applause for that. There's support for that. And there's a almost kind of like loss of memory that goes along with that, that we don't have the privilege of, that is maintained by the white supremacist construct. It's okay to be that. It's all right to be that. You could ascend to the highest levels of government in this country and be that. And it's all right. So that's what struck me most, was that as consequential as yesterday was, it can also be very inconsequential in our media landscape and our social consciousness 2 years from now.
Yeah, it's the story of America, man. To your point, like, this is all writing on the wall, but again, it's seeing that we're always catching the short end of the stick, yet with the soul of this country and the voice and the reason and the North Star, I just think America right now is going through its own reckoning of who it has always been, to the professor mentioned. And when you're trying to make a change, or when you have no other choice but to change, you got to face yourself in the mirror. And I just think this is America's mirror right now, man. America is facing itself because it turned on itself. And now for it to be something radically different, it has to figure out how does it reckon with what it has always been to basically reconcile what it needs to be going forward. And I just think this is just the first stage. It's the first stage of the seismic change in psyche, mentality, overall society. I mean, we even started this podcast talking about like being taken on a journey now, right? America is on this journey. It has to reckon with all its pain, its greatness, its lack of greatness, its how it got started, its foundation, its genesis, all of that shit. It got to reckon with all the smoke now to really, truly move forward. Or this is just kind of it. Every great nation in the past, if you want to deem it great based off European standards, had to go through this, right? The Romans, the British Empire, even a lot of remnants of the Kemetic Empire, like all those different empires of civilizations all went through some type of seismic change. Either they changed for the good and went off to history never to be really thought about, or they became something different. And I just think now America is really struggling, trying to become something different because it has no choice. I mean, look at the South, bro. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, right? Man, that state haven't flipped blue in decades. It flipped blue because more of us are moving to the South and we're bringing our political power with it and we're changing it. And that's what 45's audience don't like. That this is a new America that they do not like. They dream of the old America, the overt racism, the silencing of women, not having as many immigrants. Even using the word foreigner feels weird, right? It's like, why would you call someone a foreigner? This is just a brand new day. And this is just the cough that's basically getting worse before it becomes a non-cough or whatever.
I take your point. I think I just don't have the optimism. This country's never been great at integration. What we're doing right now after our journey is integrating our learning, taking what we experienced, digesting that, noting it, adapting our lives as a result of it, adapting our bodies as antennas for right and wrong and benefit, not benefit, whatever it might be. We are doing that process of thoughtful integration of all of that learning into something that is there to propel us forward. This country doesn't do that, right? It adapts. It creates the fallacy of law and order that ultimately is a statement about what we will be or the way that we act and go about treating each other. But it's not something that is truly affecting the consciousness of this country. And that's where the loss is. Like, that's where the real loss is. And that's the thing that affects my optimism. Not optimistic about us, my family, the things that we are learning and seeing and the mistakes that we as a people, as Black people, just cannot make in regards to our trust of this country and our trust of protection and rights. I'm optimistic there that we can do something about that for us. And the people that we welcome into our circles, into our universes, are going to be progressive to that. I'm not optimistic about this country's ability to integrate. I think it's been proven over and over again that it just has no interest in that. Every episode, we dive into a topic on fatherhood and parenthood that we think important to explore more deeply. It may be the result of a life event, a subject that we've all wanted to discuss, or something happening in society and culture affecting us as parents.
Can I kick it about rites of passage? When I thought about the storming of the Capitol, they say about 30-something thousand people. I asked myself, how many fathers and grandfathers, fathers and sons are in that mix? I don't know how many, but I would stake my pinky finger that there was at least one pair.
We saw families, kids.
Yeah, they're out there.
You know, this podcast is about Black fatherhood. And I look at historically how when our forebears were lynched, it was a family enterprise. There were fathers, there were sons watching the bodies of our forefathers, foremothers. 1863, the research project we're working on, Fighting Dark, there was families out killing Black people in the streets of New York. Fresh off a ceremony with you, not quite father, son, but just like two brothers whose fathers were friends. There's things that like AD and I may have done, even like at the studio, that wasn't meant to be a rites of passage, but it's like, oh yeah, Adrian's solo exhibition. You know what I'm saying? We're going to be there. We're going to record it because it's not just an exhibition. This is a major solo show, Suspicious Prisms by AD. We have different types of rites of passage through different parts of our lives that are ceremonial. And part of what is where I am interested in shifting our energy is not spending 90% of our capacity to think around critiquing and pointing out white supremacism, but asking ourselves what types of ceremonies and rites of passages are we creating for our children that is going to lead them in a direction of Blackness that is an inclusive, powerful, global, intergalactic sense of being that does not involve hating and killing other people. And that is part of the bridge that I feel I want to invest more of my time in, because we can talk about whiteness until the cows come home. How do we begin to pivot our energy from unpacking our trauma to the therapist to integrating and getting out of the therapist's office and making sure that we're spending adequate time in developing rites of passages for our 2-year-olds, our 13-year-olds, and how we continue to tend to our young adults who are still going through rites of passage. So in our final moments, if I may, I'd like us to think about that a bit out loud.
Oh, I can tell you. I know for me, I got a 2-year-old, right? A lot of this shit, he don't know what's going on right now, but he's going to read about it. But either way it goes, he's going to live the American experience. I just know these next 16 years are essential for me cultivating a human being to be a great human being. Therefore, I have to surround Garvey with the right environment that's going to allow him to thrive, because he's going to have roadblocks, adversities, and issues in life. But I got to prepare, me and his mom, my wife, have to prepare him for these things. So I know the first thing we got to do is put him in an environment that he can, one, understand and know himself and be comfortable with himself. And that's him total self. Him as Garvey attached to us, him as Garvey attached to a community, him as Garvey attached to a whole group of people, him as Garvey being a Black man, right? A young Black man. I know the next thing I got to do, I'm going to have to get him battle ready, bro. I mean, I cannot send Garvey into this world without the right tools to understand that when he run across something, that he would be able to understand it, synthesize it, and deal with it. I cannot send him into a world where he can go have to put his head in the sand and just hope that it goes away. That's just not how I was raised. My dad told me at a young age that, hey, man, when you run across the police, keep your goddamn mouth shut. You can probably battle them in court. You cannot battle them on the streets. He told me that when I was, I don't know, 7, 8 years old. I don't know if I go that extreme with Garvey, but I may have to. I'm ready, right? I can't just sit here and say I won't do it. I've got to be ready to do that, right? And on top of that, bro, I have to also make sure that when Garvey even go into professional environments, that he understand how to read a room very well. Like, we might have to teach Garvey how to be a thinker, how to be a fighter, and how to be a survivor, but also how to thrive too. It's like multiple fronts, man. And I know I can't do that by myself. I have to do that with people who can put those things in him. Because I really believe in this idea of parents can't raise a child by themselves. They have to raise with a community. It just doesn't work by yourself. You can't be into your own island. That's why I can't really wait to me and Nicole and Garvey to kind of get back to the Northeast, because I want him to grow up there. I want him to be around multicultural kids. I don't want him to grow up in this world of black and white, man and woman, heterosexual, homosexual, American, immigrant. Like, it's, I just know most of America is that, right? And that's the world that I came from. I really can't speak for you, brothers, but it seems that we all more or less have a lot of those things in our background. And I want Garvey to more or less understand that if nothing else, you can see things multidimensional, because that's probably the best way to more or less look at everything in life. You can't look at everything as binary. There's like three aspects to anything and everything in life, and that's X, Y, Z. And I feel like raising him around people like yourselves, it's going to give him that multidimensional foresight and just vision that he probably won't appreciate from even his parents, but he'll see it from you all. So that's the rites of passage I got to give him. I got to make him more like Kal-El from Superman, right? The story of Moses or whatever you want to call that. We got to put him in a capsule, man, ready to go out and be great somewhere else, potentially. Probably not be this country. It may be this country. It may not be certain parts of this country. We got to prepare him like that. Because if I don't look at the world in that manner with him and kids like him, we're doing a disservice to all those kids. I cannot tell Garvey to go out and say, hey, just get a good job, get a nice house, and shut the fuck up. Anyhow, that works, bro. That's not the world we live in. Breonna Taylor tried that, and that didn't fucking work, right? She was at home and got shot the fuck up. She had a good job. It was at home, out of where everybody. Smoke still came to her. So we got to show him the real, but we also got to show him the possibilities, too. When I say we, it ain't just me and his mom. It's everybody.
I've written about this recently, and I think I spoke about this on one of our previous episodes. Yeah, being 13 is an important part of his life, an important part of his growth and development in light of COVID and lockdown and social distancing and separation from school and friendships and those kind of things. I've thought a lot about this period and how to continue to make this period and the blessing of our togetherness right now, our everyday, you know, tight togetherness right now, something that's super productive and uplifting for us, that we come out of this more connected. At his point in his development, 13 years old, he's coming into a lot of his own thoughts and feelings and wants and desires, some that he knows, some that he doesn't, some that's familiar, all that's unfamiliar. And in these years leading to now, I've worked really hard to model myself as the father that I knew that I wanted to be. We all have thoughts about fatherhood going in and who we're going to be. It was really clear for me the father I wanted to be to him. And I didn't want to sacrifice anything in that process of being that dad. And there were a lot of things I thought about and ways of being and ways I wanted to be able to talk to him and ways that I wanted him to see me and all of that. Space that I wanted to build, all those things. But he's coming into a space now where he knows how his room wants to be. You know, he knows how he wants his setup to be at his desk, you know, when he's getting ready to play and all these other things. And those can be seen as little bits of growth. But the important thing for me in reflection on this year has been figuring out and building a ceremony around him letting me know from his perspective and thinking about and growing into a relationship where he can let me know how I can be the father that he needs me to be going forward. He will continue to grow into thoughts about that. And my responsibility to understand that and to digest that and adapt to that and be that for him in the same way that I dedicated myself to being the father that I wanted to be for him for all these years prior. Like, that's something that is not just a question. And the reason why I haven't really posed it to him yet, even though it's been on my mind for 6 months, the reason why I haven't posed it to him yet, because I've been trying to figure out how to build some progressive ceremony and integration around that. And that's even at 46 now, that's going to be a rite of passage for me as well. It's a rite of passage for both of us. And what blossoms from that is the unknown. And I'm so happy to step into that unknown and have the opportunity to step into that unknown and learn again. I didn't have anybody ask me that question at that age. And I think it's an important one. I think it's an important one for fathers, men, women, whatever, to consider, because our kids grow and their minds mature and all these other influences start to impact them, and they see other families and all these things that affect how they want to be governed, how they want to be loved, how they want to be nurtured, how they want to be supported, how they want to be propelled. I think we could probably do a better job as parents overall in querying around that, listening to it and acting on it. And I think that's, for me, that rite of passage that I want to start to build and build a dialogue around. And I think I have a language and a way to do that now that I feel really good about, and I'm excited about where that can go.
No, that's clutch. And I think that, stating the obvious, but stating it for those who aren't in this virtual room with us, that I'm committed to support both of y'all brothers in you designing your rites of passage anyway would be beneficial as an ear, as a participant, whatever. You know what I mean? I think it's one of the most important things that we can build. And from a historical standpoint, we're like trapped in a resilience loop where we just maintaining is enough. Not getting killed is the goal. Having food, not being homeless is a goal, right? But there's more than that. There's more than just not being murdered. There's more than just having a roof over your head and having toilet paper and cashews and oranges. And so when we think about these rites of passage, we have to be engineers and Afrofuturists and consider, how do we build these vessels, these slingshots into the unknown, and build support around it, and just get out of the, not get out of it 100%. We got to keep our foot in the citizenship realm and make sure we participate. And there'll be some Jiminy Cricketness about blackness. We'll always be like, yo, knock, knock, Black Lives Matter. Just saying, call me later. But we also have to spend energy on, like, how do we design ceremony around building trajectory for the souls that we have these intimate connections with, these children of ours.
For Spades, you talked about it a bit, about wanting him to have a taste of the experience we had and his enthusiasm for that. What are your thoughts about, you know, is that a centerpiece, that, you know, transition that you want to build in? There are other things that have been on your mind in that regard when it comes to rite of passage for, and you guys' adult relationship?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of footage of Spades that he hasn't seen yet, that I've always wanted to compile into a ceremony where I want to give him some time just to, like, sit with some footage of himself. Because one thing that's hard, like, we don't remember learning how to walk. We don't remember being born. But I wanted to begin to give him, like, a broadband connection to part of his archive and let him sit with that for a little bit. And as an exit ticket, perhaps to have a conversation about it that can be recorded, such as we're doing now, but not for publication. And I do think that what you and I experienced in California, I think that that would be a valuable ceremony for adult children. You know what I mean? I remember the brother we're speaking about who provided the ceremony for us was like, nah, he has a son too that's an adult. He's like, we did something, but not this. I don't think it's time. You know what I'm saying? I do think it would be a goal to get to a place, whether it's father and son or it's sons and sons, but have a way to give them that gate to, like, process your past, but also put both feet into the spiritual realm and come back and have an integration. So I think that that definitely would be something that I did it when I was in his age. I was 23. It was right before he was born. I did it. So yeah, I think that that would be something, considering how profound it was for me and for us, I would definitely like to see that, something that he can experience. So yeah, I think that's on the block, and I was surprised how receptive he was off rip. So more offline to process about that, but that's something that I would like to, and just on an imagination level, whether he's 23, 33, 43, I think there should be, like, a rhythm of ceremonial practices within, like, we're both men now. So we might have to water that differently. Maybe it's like every 2 years we're doing something that is ceremonial, that is not just your rites of passage, but we're both two men on this earth. And what are we doing to like check in and water and fertilize that ground beneath both of us so that we're better men and better fathers?
Yeah, that parental adaptation to the stage that your children are in, I think is so important and something that we haven't had really. I know that as an adult, I am in the phase where I want my parents to dialogue with me as an adult who's had 46 years of experience on this earth and value experience in the ways that I want to do the same. It's not something that we do. You don't read that anywhere. There's no book that's like, your kid is an adult now. They've had experiences. Respect that. Let them be that adult. Talk to them in that regard. Share experiences, not sermons. All these things that I think are important. There's an elevation of that for me in reconnecting with some of my family and how I want to look at and think there's some more progressive things that we could be doing just as parents in our navigation of parenthood and our dialogue with our kids. It's really interesting as even through this conversation, some of the things that are sparking about that. And that's where to the conversation that led into this conversation, the maturity, the maturation of our thinking, the maturation of our perspectives, the adaptation and integration of our learnings are still important. That's been a part of our cultural practice for a very, very long time as a people that others don't have as a part of their DNA. And we just need to elevate that more. We need to bring ceremony back into our lives in significant ways. And we need to make rites of passage something that is not something that happens in childhood, but something that happens in all these phases. Well, we thank you for sticking with us for this perspective on state of the world in the moment. We appreciate you brothers sharing just, you know, hearts real openly in this one. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with more. But again, as always, the likes, the subscriptions, the views are always appreciated. But your open ears are the things that is most appreciated from all. So happy new year from us at the Stages. And let's keep pushing.
Amen. Ashe. Peace, everybody.
For real. One love. Peace.
The Stages is a production of Sauce Kitchen Studios, produced and edited by Ali Ojbe, and featuring the track Going Home by Classic Beats. That's Beats with a Z. You can find Going Home on his album Spaces in Noir, and you can find that on Apple Music, Spotify, or anywhere else you get dope-ass music.